First of all, today, do you have any questions that you would like to ask? From all that reading and research and stuff you've been doing. Yeah, the idea is that the electrons tend to be in this region of space. So you might say, here's the nucleus and here's the K shell about there, which also goes by N equals 1, see? And then the next shell tends to be around here, which is L with N equal 2. Within the principal shell, you will have subdivisions, like you can have S electrons, or P, or D, or F, within that principal shell. Now they maybe are a little closer in or a little further out, but they tend to be in that region of space, and that's a spherical region. Does that help?
Yeah, I just want to have a picture in my mind, like, when you say 6P6 or something like that.
Well, it can be a, oh, yeah, okay, 6P6, yes, it can. Okay, it's out here, six levels out here, you see. We're out here to KLMNOP, capital P. Here, so it would be out, way out here with all of this structure that was internal to them.
So it just says that there's 6P electrons in
So you can have P electrons in any of these beginning with N equal 2. See, in N equals 1, all there can be is 1s2 electrons. That's all that's possible. But when N equals 2, then you can have 2s electrons or 2p electrons up to 6.
So it just feels...
Yes, each new element that you make in your mind has everything that went before in the way of electrons, and then you throw on another one, you hang on another one.
So, where are the F and the 2F? Are they both up
in
or are they
in the F? Well, they're just in this region here, which is outside of the N equals 1 region and inside of the N equals 3 region. It's a diffuse region.
There's S at K and there's also S at
F. Right. There need not be, there need not be an S out in here. Well, that's, you can ionize it away, form an ion. The shell will be there, but it may not be occupied by any electrons. That's always a possibility. Also, you know in those luminous tubes that we were getting light from? That's a process, you see, of knocking an electron from here up into a higher shell, and then the light is emitted when it falls back again. Now, if it's an outermost electron, it can be knocked clear up to, and that's usually the case, the most common case, you knock it up to an orbital where there normally are not electrons.
And if it falls back,
gives off energy. And the energy it gives off depends on a lot of factors, but it can be anything from in the ultraviolet on up into infrared that your eye can't see, or it can be the colors in between that your eye can see. Depends on the energy of the electron in this shell compared to this shell. And that would vary from atom to atom. Jeff?
Here they're talking about different kinds of radiation emitted by radioactive elements, and one of them was called K-electron shell capture. What exactly is the mechanism and function?
We have not considered much about reaction of the nucleus. That's called nuclear chemistry. The nucleus can decompose to form fission products, or it can absorb neutrons, electrons, or protons. There are some radioactive elements which do a strange thing. Here, you see, this is the K shell that is closest
to the nucleus. And there's a thing called K capture. And which an electron from here actually is captured by the nucleus. And forms a neutron and decreases the atomic number by one.
Does it give off any energy?
Probably. There is a beryllium isotope in which that happens, and there are others. Beryllium is the only one I recall. Pressure will influence this. See, if you apply an exceedingly high pressure, these shells get compressed. And there's a detectable effect in some elements where you squeeze them to very high pressure. The shell is squeezed down a little closer and makes the probability of capture that electron by the nucleus higher. And that's an experimentally observed fact. Now, these regions represent regions where it's most likely to find an electron. But this probability factor I mentioned that we use in quantum mechanics, the electron can be anywhere. At any instant of time, this electron may be there, or it may be at infinity, if you can believe such things. But the probabilities allow that. And so you might say, well, how, you know, this is a tremendous distance. This is, the nucleus is 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, and this distance across here is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. That's 100,000 times as large a distance. So how could this ever be captured? Well, it's the fact that the electron has a certain probability of being anywhere. And at one instant, when it happens to be at the nucleus, then it would be captured.
Two other questions. They said that there were a couple of regions inside the atom where the electron could not be. There were regions of zero probability of electron occupying that region.
That's right. That's
how does it get between those two energy levels? Nobody's
a good question. They call that tunneling. There are lots of paradoxes in science. Yes, we haven't got into the details of it, but this so-called wave function will give you the probability for certain types of electrons, S or P or D or F, being someplace. All right, now, for S electrons, if that's the nucleus, there is some shell out here, like a thin egg shell, only it's round, it's a ball, you see. Where the probability of the electron being is the highest. So if I were to draw a graph of that, there's the nucleus right there. It'd be like this. The probability is it can be anywhere. But it's very high, you see, right out here. There's the high probability of where the electron is. But it can be put out here at infinity, or it can be right at the nucleus. Now for P electrons, it's different. And I forget exactly how the probability goes, but I believe there are two nodes in the thing. There's some kind of probability about like that, and then it's down to about zero probability, and then it's up at a higher note. And these things get complicated. And as Jeff says, in some instances the mathematics says there's zero probability of the electron being there. But then there's a probability that it's there, and a probability it's there. And if there's zero probability that it's at this point, then how does it get from there to there? It's a question that's always bothered me too. You run into that phenomenon in solids in a different case, and scientists are up to any paradox. It doesn't matter. You can fix it in your mathematics. I mean, you can draw a mathematical curve and write an equation for it that will do this. You can draw an equation that will touch zero there and on there, and so you put your faith in your mathematics and don't worry about an explanation, see? And that's what you do. But if you want to use a model, and solid-state physicists like to use models, they have the same darn thing in solids, which are much more complex. And they say that the electron tunnels from there to there. It's as though it goes underground, you know, and then comes up again.
Wait a minute.
Now you see it, now you don't. They use that word. It's just a word to get around the paradox, that's all. You have such a thing as electron tunneling. So if you ever think that your religion is paradoxical and you're going to discard it because there are a couple of paradoxes in your religion, forget it, there are more in science. It's not a good excuse. Someday we hope we have all the answers to these things.
Okay.
But science has many paradoxes, but I don't discard science because there's some stupid things like this in it.
If you take a proton, it just have a free proton scan, they're starting to they'll spontaneously decay and then micron to turn into a neutron, okay?
Alright.
You take a neutron and you just send it out in space and spontaneously decay, emitting a positron in the form of a proton, okay?
Yeah.
Well, or maybe it's vice versa, maybe the particles they emit or the opposite, I'm not sure, but a neutron weighs more. So how can a proton sit there and emit? Yeah, a proton emits a positron because a neutron.
There has to be energy from some other source due to motion or something else.
Well, no, I mean, they can theoretically, we just sit it out there and spontaneously decay in so many hundred thousands of a second. And then the neutron is sitting there again with the spontaneous decay back in the proton. If you take the, you also have a surplus of energy because if you take the positron and electron and collide them, then they cancel each other out and they give you pure energy.
You can give me any argument you want, but I can always escape because I believe in the law of the conservation of energy. Don't believe in the law of conservation of matter anymore, but I do of energy. So, whatever you tell me about mass and whatnot, I just say, well, there has to be energy absorbed or given off.
Where?
Okay, you ask me where. I say, I don't care, but there has to be. Because I believe in the law.
Okay.
Well, there are lots of questions like that, Jeff, that are sort of unanswerable. The reason you hang on to your theory is that it does have some good in it, you see. Maybe there's some bad in it and some paradoxes, but ignore those because there's a lot of good in it. And maybe, you see, maybe man himself is incapable of having the pure mathematics or the pure, his mind is not capable of it, perhaps. And maybe this is the best we can do. Maybe it's the best we can do in the understanding of religious principles, too, for all I know. If there seem to be paradoxes in Mormonism, maybe it's because of our limits as human beings, for all I know. But it's only the non-thinker that would discard a good thing because, say, of one paradox, like people will say the Negro question is a paradox, therefore to heck with Mormonism. I know intellectual Mormons have done that. They're no longer, they say, remove my name from the rolls. This paradox has just made Mormonism untenable for me. But if that guy had dealt deeply in other subjects, I don't care what it is. I think it stands out more strongly in science, perhaps, than it does in sociology. The whole subject of sociology is a paradox. So you can't see it. I mean, you're immersed in one big paradox. But science has a lot of things that are fairly solid, and then these paradoxes, some of which we've been talking about. But a scientist doesn't discard the whole thing on account of a couple of paradoxes because it's useful to him. Just ignore it. Okay?
Ever since you started studying about atom structure, I keep remembering what you said, that this isn't really what atoms look like, but it's just convenient to describe them this way.
That's the best you can do, yeah. If you want to be a purist, there are a couple of general branches of science, those who like mental pictures and those who don't care. All they want is mathematics to describe their science. Most scientists do want a picture, and so we have some of these pictures I have drawn. And they're true in that they're useful.
But is this the best picture that's drawn, or can if we were capable of understanding it, could you draw a more accurate picture than this?
Well, no, I can't. All I can do is make the picture fuzzier. Because you get into the law of probability. Science, like everything else, becomes a captive of the laws of probability, of chance. The only reason that there is anything concrete in science at all, taking the viewpoint I'm now taking, that it's all based in probability and chance, is because you're dealing with so many, your sample is so large, you're dealing with trillions and trillions and trillions of atoms or molecules in the tiniest speck that man can you know, take a hold of. And so when you have that many simple-minded things, supposedly, compared to people, people are more unpredictable, I suppose, in some ways. There are only certain things that atoms, the restrictions on atoms and molecules seem small. They don't seem to be able to think or have too much free choice. But it gets back to the laws of probability. Well, that's a fuzzy concept. That's not nearly as neat as saying here's an eggshell out here that's spherical where the electron is.
Well, it has its highest probability of being there, but it can, as I said before, be right in the prism throughout an infinity at any instant of time. It just has its highest probability of being there. Now, not only that, we're talking as though the electron is a particle right now, see? But we don't know. Maybe it's a wave. Well, how do you know where a wave is, see? So, and if you want to worry, you know, about details in religion, you got the exact kind of thing to worry about in science, maybe even more so. We think God is a person, at least in Mormonism. That's fairly concrete. But in science, you don't know whether an electron's a wave or a particle, and besides that, you don't know where it is. And there are lots of problems.
One thing I wanted to ask about was, we draw it on a board like it was moving in two dimensions, you know?
Right.
It's going in a nice circle. Like
right.
That. Well, how does it really move? Is it like, is it random and goes like this? Or?
It's random, you see. Now, it's a three-dimensional thing. Here's how to visualize it. The particle at any instant is here, and another instant it's there. And how it got there, it didn't have to go in between, you see? It's just like we were talking about here. It's here, and it's there, and it's there at any instant. It's just there. But if I take a moving picture of the thing, time and time again I take a moving picture, and then I look at the population density of where it is, you'll find that the density is most out at this particular radius.
Does it circle?
No, you can't. If you make, the scientists thought it circled, because they made the analogy to the planets going around the sun, see?
Yeah.
But the new idea is, no, it doesn't circle, it's just there, you know, completely random. It's not going like that and then switches and goes like that. It's just a random where it is, just random.
It almost makes it sound like it just shows up here and then it disappears and it shows up over here.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't move between those spots?
No, it just shows up there and then it appears over there. See, maybe that's its paradoxical property. It's a wave and then it's electron, that's a wave and then it's electron. Who knows?
Now, isn't there some law that says we can tell where it is or which way it's going? We can't tell you both at once?
Yes, it's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Heisenberg's
law
of uncertainty.
That's a good test.
The only thing that is certain is the law.
Dr. Hall.
Yeah?
Is this the real basis of science, though? Sounds like you could be accepting.
Well, I don't know. Science, you have to remember that what man does is invention. We invent these concepts to explain what we think we see. Now maybe we're not seeing things correctly, but we do the best we can. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says that the product of the momentum of something, P, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute. Well, let's put it this way. Use the symbol delta for uncertainty. The uncertainty in the momentum of a thing. Now momentum is equal to the mass of something, P. P is a symbol for that. P is equal to the mass of something times its velocity. So a baseball going 100 miles an hour has more momentum than a marble going 100 miles an hour because the baseball weighs more. Or two marbles, each of the same weight, will have different momentum if the velocity of one is faster than the other. So if one marble is going 200 miles an hour, it has more momentum than the other marble, which is only going 100 miles an hour. Now, let me tell you why we use the concept of momentum. The amount of damage that a baseball, let's take two marbles. The amount of damage a marble would do going 100 miles an hour when it stopped and hit something would be less than the same marble going 200 miles an hour. Doesn't that fit your reasonable concept? Okay, or if you have a baseball that weighs, I don't know what they weigh, say 100 grams going 100 miles an hour, that'll do less damage than a baseball that weighs 1,000 grams going the same speed. Those are intuitive concepts, I think. Well, that's why you use this thing, momentum. It's the product of the velocity times the mass. It's the amount of damage a particle can do, so to speak, if it's traveling and then is stopped by colliding or something. The uncertainty in the momentum of something. Times the uncertainty in the position of something. And this is just considering one direction. Here's the x-axis going that way. So if between there and there is where you don't know where it, or where it is, or its highest probability between there and there, you call that distance delta x. It's some distance along the x-axis. This is of the order of Planck's constant h. And h, I've even forgotten what it is. It's something times 10 to the minus 27, and the dimensions on the thing are energy divided by frequency. An energy divided by frequency. Dimensions on. Anybody remember what Planck's constant is?
Well, this says here 6.6 times 10 to the minus 27 erg seconds.
6.6 times 10 to the minus 27 erg seconds. That makes sense. Erg is a measure of energy. And remember that radiant energy is equal to h times nu, and nu is the frequency, which has the dimensions of 1 over second. So we cancel that out and leave this with the dimensions of energy. Well, that doesn't make sense. Let's see. Frequency per second. Well, it does still make sense. Yeah, what I said was correct. Alright, now what this means can sort of be demonstrated by trying to see substances that are smaller and smaller in size. When men first invented light microscopes, they had a magnifying power of maybe 10 times, and then they improved them to 100 times. And then 400 times. But if you get up to a magnification of around 1,000 times in a light microscope, you start getting into trouble because of a principle we have already discussed. Let's say this is the wavelength of light. Well, if your particle that you're looking at with that wavelength is some great big thing about that long, say it's about 10 wavelengths long, your light can tend to define the particle. But if the thing I'm trying to look at gets down to where it's no bigger than the wavelength of light, then I start getting interference effects. Remember the old thing we've been talking about. When your light gets down to the same size of something, we talked about radar and how you can have holes in the reflector. Radar doesn't even know it's there because it's longer wavelength than the size of the hole in the reflector. When radiant energy, such as light or other electromagnetic radiation, it's the same size as the particle, you can't see the particle anymore because you get dispersion effects. The light gets bounced off in different ways and you get interaction between the particle and this. Well, that's one way of explaining the phenomena. The other is by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle right here. This thing here says the same thing. And another thing that says the same thing is that there is an interaction between the observer, the measuring device and the thing you're trying to measure, let's say the object of measurement. Now let me explore this idea. We're really getting into the philosophy of science today. Here's the idea, and in practice this is what happens. Anytime some kind of an instrument, my eye or my ear, are an invented instrument that a guy invents, like a scientist inventing a voltmeter to measure voltage or amperes, or whatever it is, the measuring device interacts with what you're trying to measure. So in theory, you can never measure any quantity to perfection in science. And that includes, it's to see something and magnify it a million times, like you'd like to do, so you can see tinier and tinier. That's a measuring thing in a way. I'm trying to see what that's like. Anytime you try to measure with finer and finer precision, you get into trouble because you eventually run into the philosophical concept, which seems to be borne out by all practical experiments, that when I try to measure something, I affect what I measure. So when you design an instrument to measure something, you try to design that instrument so that it interacts a minimum amount with the thing you're trying to measure. Now, scientists believe that's true of all instruments. It doesn't matter whether it's a scale for weighing something, a voltmeter, an ammeter, a microscope, any kind of an instrument that you use to try and learn something, particularly to try to learn something on a finer and finer scale, you get into more and more trouble. So there is an idea afloat in science that it's impossible to ever know the ultimate because of the interaction between the observer, so to speak, and the thing you're trying to observe. You get an interaction. Now, they try to give you an example in most textbooks of light. Now, if I try and look at something that is smaller and smaller, and I look at light as being a particle, a bullet, for example, if the thing I'm trying to look at gets down to be as small as my bullet, if my bullet comes in and hits that, it's going to move it. Isn't that right? And then I don't see it. I moved it out of the way. It's out of focus. Because the light, and there's energy in the light, and whether you regard it as a wave or as a bullet, a little particle, either way, that energy is transferred to this very, very tiny thing that's no bigger than the wavelength of your light, and it moves it so that you don't get a clear and accurate picture of it. And that's the principle involved in all measurements. You could say, so to speak, whatever you apply to make your measurement, sometimes it'll be a voltage, sometimes it'll be a current, a sound wave, an electromagnetic wave. Whatever you apply, if you get down to a fine enough scale, and that's defined by the wavelength of the thing you're trying to do the measurement with compared to what you're trying to measure, then it's going to move it, and you can't see it clearly. Now this says even more than what I've said so far. What this says is if I can define some region here very fine, very small scale, then I don't know the momentum of the thing. This gets on a big scale. See, this thing times that equals a constant. So if this is little, this is big. If this is little, this is big. So if I want to know one quantity with preciseness, like the momentum, then I don't know its position. If I know the position precisely, then I don't know its momentum. And when you make an analysis of the situation, you don't know anything about something unless you know both these things. You have to know both those things to really know about something in the atomic level, in the atomic world. And if you know one accurately, then you know the other one very inaccurately. So you can't win. Take your choice. Which property do you want to know with accuracy? And you can usually devise a scheme of measuring one thing, but not the other. Now, to see things at finer and finer scale, you shorten your wavelength. So they went from visible light in bacteriology to using ultraviolet light, and then recording the picture on photographic films. And this enabled them to go to shorter wavelengths and see more finely. And then from that we went to electron microscopes. Now the wavelength of an electron is much smaller than that of ultraviolet light. And the ultimate thing we have right now in trying to see things on a very fine scale is the electron microscope. And people think they have almost seen an atom with an electron microscope nowadays. Jeff?
We were trying to figure out something that's useful in an electron with a small wavelength. They were trying different things, but the problem is that really small particles, like neutrinos, that they don't bounce up, they just go right through because there's nothing to stop.
See, that's another thing you run into with electrons. Electrons, you may treat them as a wave, but they also carry an electrical charge. And that can cause you some problem. Now, as Jeff suggested, there are things called neutrinos, which are small like electrons. They weigh less than electrons are the same.
They are supposed to have almost zero. They have zero mass. To an electron, they have almost zero mass, but they do have some calculable mass.
Okay, so they don't have anything, they're nothing, almost. But with that, if you get an electron or a microscope, you see that you use those to see with, then the interaction ought to be small, because it would be so small and so insignificant compared to what you're trying to see, that you ought to be able to see something even finer. And someday you'd like to be able to see the nucleus of an atom. We haven't quite seen an atom yet, which is 10 to the minus centimeters big, and the nucleus, you see, is 100,000 times smaller. You'd like to see what that is like.
How do you propose to isolate an atom so that you can look at it with anything on it? You're bound to have other atoms in front and back.
You do it with solids. As a matter of fact, that's the whole trick to the electron microscope. You never look at the object itself with an electron microscope. Did you know that? You coat your object with a thin coating of a very heavy atom, such as tungsten. You take a fly, or whatever it is, that you want to look at in fine detail, or your bacteriological specimen. And it has to be dried out so that there's no moisture or anything, no volatile materials. And then you put it in a vacuum chamber where you have a good vacuum. And then you heat up some tungsten or gold or osmium. They use osmium a lot, or osmium oxide even. Something that's very dense and heavy, has a lot of momentum. And in a vacuum, as you heat this off, these atoms go everywhere, and they completely coat your specimen. And so then your electron comes and hits the tungsten, or the osmium, the very heavy element, and then it goes off and through the electromagnetic lenses and whatnot, and it's reflected onto the cathode ray tube, like a TV tube.
Well, I had heard that that was a peculiarity of the scanning electron microscope, but the older ones, the older type, didn't require that.
All right, that's a different kind of a thing. Scientists are pretty smart at keeping the game if they keep working long enough at it. The microscopes in the past, electron, light microscopes, ultraviolet, or whatever, worked as though it was a lens. The idea is that here's a tiny object. Let's draw an arrow like that. And here is a lens. Now this lens may be, it'll be infinitely more complicated than just a simple lens like that. But the principle is hereby illustrated. All right, that is focused like this. If you go back here far enough, you have the right lens, the image is inverted, and you find the arrow over here, but you get a magnification through the lens. I didn't show that right. This crossover is supposed to be over on the side of the lens. But anyway, that's the idea. Let me draw my lens down in here. That is the focal point of the lens. Now, that's the principle they worked on. Now, since the days of radar in World War II, we do things, light hits this and the light all goes back there at once. We do things by scanning. Radar is the forerunner of television. And what you do in radar is you pick out one spot there. Let's say here's a ship. Here's a Japanese ship or something during World War II. The radar sends out a beam that hits there, and then reflected back, and you record what you see there, and then it moves over, and it scans. It may do this a million times a second. So it only looks at a little tiny bit of the ship at an instant. The ordinary microscope and telescope and all the optical and electron microscope devices in the past look at the whole thing at once. Television does the same thing. There's a dot presented on your screen, like that. Then another dot. Across a line, and then it moves down a line, and it goes across there. Some 440 times a second, it goes across a line. It's like the newspaper printing. You ever notice a newspaper picture that has just dots of various intensities to make up the picture? Television's sort of the same idea. So you scan. Now, if you scan, your information collecting capacity is vastly improved. So in the scanning microscope, they can hit the object with an electron that will bounce back. See, you used higher and higher power electrons in illuminating your subject in the first electron microscopes. They had so much energy, they would pass right through the fly's eye or whatever it was you're trying to look at. They'd pass right through and you wouldn't get anything back. But now, you can hit it with a much lighter electron and it scans. And they do more complicated things than that, too. They have auger electrons and other effects that are slower moving, and so you can use a fleshy thing and still get a picture of it. I'm glad you brought that subject up. My mind was still thinking of the total illumination, total at an instant picture like we used to do. Now they do the same thing in taking pictures with the satellites, and they do the same thing way out there in space. If you had to send back all the information in a picture at once, we would not see Mars or Venus or these other things. But they send back one little tiny speck of information and scan, scan, scan. I think, what do they say? Some of these scans where they're out there a million miles take 4 hours or more. Your television set goes clear across the picture 440 times a second. But they'll take hours to get their scan, and they can increase the amount of information because they're not trying to get all the information at once. They're just trying to get a little piece of information there, and then they, so to speak, paste on. It's a paste-up. You see, you paste all the little bits of information together to get the total picture. You get the idea? Taking a picture is sort of an information retrieval kind of a thing. And if your object is standing reasonably still, or if you can synchronize yourself with its motion, like if Saturn or something is turning and your satellite turns at the same speed, it's the same as if it were standing still, and you can take 4 hours to take the picture and you still get a good picture. And you just take little bits of picture and then you put it all together. And they use computers to enhance these things, and that gets to be a pretty complicated thing too. Who asked that question? You did. Does that straighten things out for me or for you?
Well, no.
No.
Because the article I read said that you needed decoding for the scanning microscope and not for the ones that just brute force shot the electrons through it.
Well, maybe they use it both places on occasion. But recent developments with scanning have made it possible to pick easygoing electrons off that can bounce off, or which automatically come off by some electron fluorescence effect or something. And then you collect those. You collect them in some systematic scanning process that has a one-to-one correspondence between the final picture and the little submicroscopic thing you're trying to look at. The real advantage of the scanning microscopes is the depth of focus. Now that's another phenomena of photography and microscopes and whatnot. The higher the magnification you go to, the less depth you see in a picture. Have any of you ever fooled with any kind of a light microscope in a biology class or anything? If you'll notice, say you have 10 power on and here's your specimen, a bug of some kind. Well, at 10 power, you can pretty well see his feet down here and his antlers or whatever they are up here. And you go to 50 power and you'll see, well, maybe I can see that much of him, but if I have that much in focus, I can't see this. You go to 100 power, maybe you only see a little bit of this thing in focus. And then at 1,000 power, maybe you can just barely see a hair on one of the little antler things. And you can't see anything below. But with this scanning business, you have depth of focus, and that's why a fly or some tiny little insect looks so clear. Have you seen the picture on a scientific magazine sometimes? Just great depth of focus, much greater clarity. In these scanning systems, it's possible to take care of the problem of depth of focus, and it has certainly been a great help to biologists.
and looking at little tiny things, seeing the whole thing at once. What they used to do, they'd take a photograph. Say you had to work at 100 power. You want a detail. You take a photograph here, and new focus here, new focus here. And then you try and put all those pictures together, usually in a drawing. A guy would spend months looking at that little thing and taking photographs at different levels and then trying to put those all together, usually in a drawing that he did by hand. A real good artist would make an illustration. Now you can do it with a scanning microscope and get a beautiful picture, all in depth.
Okay. I'm not sure whether you want to talk about this since we're not on the subject, but why would a gas, like when you brought that box in here and showed us the different gases, why would that give a bright line spectroscope to the continuous spectrum?
Atoms of light elements have sharply discrete lines. As you go to heavier elements where you may have, say, 90 electrons, then the lines get so close together you almost have a continuous spectrum. But with a good spectroscope, you can even sort out individual lines, even though there may be thousands of them, with an element of high atomic weight. We call this line spectra because it's due to electrons being promoted up to higher atomic orbitals and then dropping back. And that's a discrete quantized energy jump. Now when you get up to 90 electrons here, the more electrons there are, the more energy places they are where it can be. There may be little tiny jumps where the energy you measure, the difference in wavelength, is very small. And the lines would be very close together in a spectrogram. Well, these are called line spectra. Now, the thing you're asking about is called continuous spectra. Continuous spectra comes from hot bodies. Now, sometimes the hot body may have the line spectra superimposed on. In fact, it often does have the line spectra imposed on top of the continuous spectra. For example, radiation from the sun, which we usually think of as continuous spectra, also has line spectra in it, which can be sorted out with the proper scientific instruments. Now, to have continuous spectra, you get it from what is called a black box. You take a box with a tiny aperture, and you heat the inside of that box. It's called black box radiation. So it's hot in here, and you get out of that box through a tiny aperture, line spectra, or continuous spectra of all wavelengths depending on the temperature. A wavelength depends on a law that is proportional to 1 over the temperature to the 4th power. Might be the reverse. It might be that the temperature is proportional to 1 over lambda to the 4th. I'm sorry, I forgot. There's a 4th law of power, anyway. And so there's a distribution of frequencies, and that distribution, if this is increasing energy increases with frequency, wavelength. I'm sorry, with frequency, or 1 over the wavelength. Then, if you have this kind of distribution of radiant energy, continuous, not lines appearing at certain places, but absolutely infinitesimal distance apart, as you increase temperature, this line will shift its maximum to higher and higher energies. And this law, believe it or not, was actually used, this kind of experiment, measuring the energy that come from here as you increase the temperature inside this hot black box, which has this tiny pinhole opening. This value
Planck's constant came out of that experiment. That is the first determination of the value of this universal constant, which appears all throughout theoretical science. It was involved in the kind of question you just asked. How come line spectra? How come continuous spectra? What's the relationship between the temperature of a hot body and its... There appeared a constant in here, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the equation. H, Planck's constant, appeared in this thing. An unknown constant appeared, which Planck discovered, and he gave it the name H. Let me look in this book and see if they have the correct law for this black body radiation, because I've forgotten the details of it. We need to look under black body radiation. Not in this book. Let's try Planck's constant and see what it says. You guys are asking me questions clear up in senior level chemistry.
Anybody can ask questions.
Planck's constant set. No, they can't. The hardest part of the problem is asking the right questions about the problem. 17 and 75. 17.
You could ask intelligent questions.
17 and 75. No, they don't go into it in this book. So. I don't remember the exact relationship. There's a fourth power relationship between temperature and wavelength, and Planck's constant appears in the equation. In the radiant energy, what you try to do, you see, is get an equation that reproduces this curve for a given temperature. And Planck is the guy who investigated that and discovered this kind of a thing, and the fact that you had continuous radiation. Now, many things approximate continuous radiation. The tungsten filament in a, well, that's the tungsten filament in these bulbs in this room. That's approximately continuous radiation. It's a hot, solid body that is radiating light. If you have fluorescent lights, it's line spectra. Now, inside the fluorescent tube is mercury vapor. I ever tell you how a fluorescent tube works? Well, that's good chemistry. Let's tell you about that. 1 minute at the door. Here's a fluorescent tube.